Hello and welcome to the Russian Terror and Macron's Flex episode of Intrigue Explained. I'm John Fowler, co-founder of International Intrigue, the only daily briefing written by former diplomats. And with me, as always, I've got Dmitry Grozbinsky, the founder and director of Explained Trade, a trade consultancy based in Geneva. Dmitry, how are you? And also, a book, tell us.
I am well and slightly mortified. Yes, I have been working on a book for about the past 2 years on and off, and it has finally been released for pre-sale.
So exciting.
I am in horror that people may finally read it. I am a trembling ball of imposter syndrome, but so far everyone has been phenomenally kind and encouraging, which actually doesn't help because they haven't read it.
How do you know someone hasn't read my book? They say it's good.
They like the title and I'm like, good, stop reading there. Just buy it, put it on your shelf, go.
Jokes aside, I'm looking forward to reading it. I think it's going to be one of those books that, I mean, you're a very good communicator and trade is a difficult thing to communicate. So if I know you well, which I do, I think it'll be a great book to kind of get your head around things that people need to know about trade, right? And why politicians lie about it, Dmitry. Give us the title before we move on.
Yeah, so it's Why Politicians Lie About Trade and What You Need to Know About It. It's me explaining trade, sort of the way we try to explain things on this podcast, and you guys try to do in International Intrigue.
Fantastic.
In a way that doesn't insult people's intelligence, but respects their time and their likely level of interest.
We will have a link to that for sure in the show notes, and we're going to continue pushing it in our newsletter. I've also got Helen. Helen, hello, my co-founder at International Intrigue, world traveler. Regale us with where you are in the world this week.
I am up with the birds in Australia this morning. So g'day from down under. I'm in Sydney, Australia, where Intrigue just hosted our first ever event on Friday. Dare I say it was a success and lots of merch was given out. So I'm going to be based here for the next couple of weeks while I await my visa run. So it's a less exciting reason here. But while I'm here, you know, feel free to get in touch with me and we can catch up. Says no one, as no one slides into my DMs.
You have a lot of issues, but one of them is not popularity. You'll be absolutely fine finding people to have beers with in Sydney. I'm obviously John Fowler. I'm the co-founder of International Intrigue. I have to apologize for my voice. I've been a bit sick.
Sultry, sexy voice this week.
Well, I feel dreadful. I'm assured that the voice will at least be listenable for a period of time anyway. But I think running around London on different time zones and not sleeping and then sitting in the back of an airplane has done me in. So I will try and talk less, which will be music to everybody's ears, but let's get cracking because I think this is we've kind of delayed this week's recording a little bit. And I think we wanted to talk about France and what the heck is going on with Emmanuel Macron's new strident posture on the world stage. And he's quite literally flexing his muscles. We can talk about that in a little bit. But before that, let's talk about Russia, Dmitry. We had the elections, I use that word exceptionally loosely. We had the elections, about a week ago now, I think it was. But more pressingly, just before we're recording, about yesterday it was, there was news of this horrible terrorist attack in Moscow. So maybe Dmitry, you start us off with just, I don't know, any reflections on what's going on in Russia in the last week or so?
Sure. So let's, as you did there, let's maybe begin with the elections. The elections, and we're all using that word with as many sarcastic square quotes as we can summon up, went through, you would have to say, fairly successfully for Putin. The level of disruption and protest was comparatively minimal. There were very scattered incidents of people basically trying to firebomb voting offices, but it's a gigantic country. There were a small handful of these incidents. And the opposition, including the opposition that was sort of spurred on by Navalny's death, organized a kind of protest thing where they got a whole bunch of people to turn up to vote at exactly midday. So at exactly midday on voting day, there are a bunch of people.
What's your read on that? Because I mean, the Western media absolutely loves to kind of blow those things up, which, you know, good, because, you know, it's definitely news. But you've been on the record, and by on the record, I mean on Twitter before, saying this stuff is massively overblown. It's not a sign of, you know, more broad pushback and that kind of stuff. Is that the case of this one, do you reckon?
Well, I would say the day after the election, if I were Vladimir Putin and I were looking at the opposition and seeing that the most sort of visible, most powerful gesture they could summon mere weeks after the death of one of their figurehead leaders at my hands, let's face it, was to do what I am telling them to do and come out and vote, thus raising the participation numbers, but just kind of all do it at the same time in order to reassure one another that, yes, there are more people who don't love the way things are than you think. If that is the level of progress of the Russian opposition, I don't think I would be losing a lot of sleep. And my view remains, as it has been on this podcast consistently, that whatever you may think about the Russian opposition and their bravery and morality, which I'll sort of never weigh in on, they are not a credible threat to Putin's power and not credible players in Russian politics. And the Western media should treat them that way and should contextualize them that way until something changes.
Okay, so nothing you saw kind of challenge that view that you've had for a while, which I think is very fair. Cause I mean, there's also, it's a little chicken and egg, right? Like there's not much they can do, but the fact that they are doing what they can doesn't necessarily mean it's larger than what they're doing. It's a little sort of reductive, but I think you summed it up well there, Dimitri. Helen, any thoughts initially on the elections? I don't think they were very surprising. Was there anything?
No.
maybe a more pointed question was: was there anything in the way that the Western media covered it that surprised you?
I mean, the only thing, apart from what Dimitri said, the only thing I want to flag is that Putin and his people didn't even bother trying to make it seem like a fake election win, right? I think he won outright at 80-something percent, whereas in other sort of rigged elections, you'd say that they won at just over 50% and that it was a respectable sort of, you know.
Unless you're Kim Jong-un,
healthy, who wins 99.6 or whatever point something percentages. That I thought was interesting. And I think that in itself was trying to send a political domestic message to Russians that he is very popular internally. And so it sort of creates this idea that, well, you know, it's just you. Everyone else likes this guy. So why aren't you on board? So I thought that was interesting. And that I think perhaps was only noted in a handful of news outlets in the West that I'd seen.
Yeah. Dimitri, help me out here for a second. So when I was living in China, I knew a few Russians and would be kind of interested talking to them about politics because they're folks who've left their country. They were by definition a little bit more internationalist, if not kind of Western internationalist, kind of aware that the world outside Russia exists. They'd been to university, that kind of stuff. They were, at least a couple of them had, and this is sort of 2016-17 for context, at least a couple of them had joined Putin's United Russia Party. And they were not Putin fans per se. They weren't, you know, anti-Putin either, but they just said, you know, it's a way to get ahead. You know, if you're going for a job and there's someone who's, you know, unbeknownst to you, super Putin-esque, you know, a party membership might help you sort of get ahead. It wasn't kind of like a, it wasn't as much as like a, you know, we've got to join the Communist Party for a job, but it wasn't also like, you know, joining a Labour Party in Australia where it's like a real true manifestation of how you feel about the world. So I always got the sense that like Russian elections were sort of free. Obviously, you can't make too many noises, but you could vote for other people. And most people didn't because they were kind of like, well, you know, what can I get out of this? A, is that a fair characterization back then? And B, has anything changed that you've seen? Is it now much more repressive? Are we starting to see Russia go the way of more like not North Korea, but getting towards that versus being free and open-ish, but, you know, just enough that Putin keeps winning?
I mean, my sense is that it varies quite a bit, but overall what you have is, first of all, Putin's electoral rigging strategy is somewhat more sophisticated than simply shooting anyone who doesn't vote his way.
Right.
So what he basically does is he first clears the field. So he makes sure that he is running against exclusively fairly clownish candidates. So generally speaking, in this election, the second highest vote total was the Communist Party. The Communist Party is a really safe opposition for United Russia and Putin, because on the one hand, they do get like 10% of the vote as like old people who remember fondly the Soviet Union cast their vote for them, but they are never going to come anywhere near winning. And the leader of their party is kind of a clown, and the leader of the Communist Party is always just this clownish figure that's slightly ridiculous. So they don't challenge Putin. So that's going on. At the same time, anytime a serious candidate emerges, some combination of lawfare, frankly, assassination, and other political forces remove them from the field. You've got full control of the media that is constantly pushing a Putinist narrative. And then they still rig the vote. This is the like massive masculine insecurity thing where he's not really even running against anybody, but you've still got guys with guns like poking their head into the voting booth. And some of this is local regional governors and stuff competing to demonstrate their loyalty to the satrap. Like, you've got that kind of thing going on.
Do you think it's changed since 2016? Is it getting more restrictive or is it roughly the same? He's always had his hands on the kind of mechanisms of re-election.
I cannot recall an election in which he was seriously challenged. I think it might be getting more difficult now because, again, historically, there is a he made the trains run on time phenomenon with Putin, where early on in his reign.
Well, he brought back order to a chaotic Russia, right?
Pensions got paid, salaries got paid, like a percentage of the GDP that was being generated by oil, a small percentage, got pumped back into the country. People's sort of livelihoods improved a bit. And so he's been able to say for many, many years, do you want to go back to that?
Yeah. Shall we pivot to the horrific terrorist attacks? Helen, maybe you want to give, for anybody who hasn't seen these, you want to give some background on what happened. I mean, it was only yesterday, so maybe folks haven't had a chance to see it. But do you want to take that?
Sure. I sort of woke up to this yesterday morning and in Australia and saw that there were at the time 137 and now I think over 150 or 160 Russian civilians who are dead and wounded from these attacks. So I think about 11 gunmen had stormed a concert venue, which was I think like an entertainment complex or a stadium, if you will, and, you know, shot and killed and injured these people. The current, you know, I mean, I think from what I've seen so far, these 11 have been caught and some are still sort of on the run, but they're in the outskirts of Moscow. So not in the center of Moscow, but in the suburbs. And right now the group that's come forward to take account for their attacks is a group called ISIS-K, which I know sounds like a brand of cereal, which is not obviously what they are. They are a brand or a sort of a, gosh, what's that word? They are, well, I guess they're a branch of... offshoot branch, yes. I was going to say, yeah, they
subgroup, yeah,
a subgroup of the sort of broader ISIS caliphate called ISIS Kherson, and that group, you know, largely kind of represents the former territory over Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, and Iran that this group had claimed to. So that's sort of what the attacks were. I think, you know, we're looking zooming out from it now. There's now media reports saying that the US had sort of warned the Russians about this a couple of days ago, and nothing was necessarily done about it, or it wasn't taken as seriously. And I think the key thing to remember here is that this is not a new sort of grudge. You know, this sort of ISIS-K v. Putin and Russia is not a new grudge that we're seeing. The group has been targeting, has been around since like 2015, 2016, and they have been targeting groups that are seen to be sort of very pro-West. So for example, they even think that the Taliban in Afghanistan is too pro-West and that they're not sort of fulfilling the caliphate's vision, right? So there's been attacks against sort of targets like Afghanistan, in Pakistan, and in Russia, I think even just a couple of years ago at the Russian embassy in Kabul. So this grudge, you know, I think they've been trying to target Putin for his perceived, you know, anti-Muslim policies. But this, I think this came as a really big escalation. I think the TLDR is that, you know, this is not a new grudge, but it's a big escalation in terms of what's happened. But obviously, you know, horrendous attack on civilians mainly.
Yeah, it is horrific.
Sorry, and the word I was trying to think of is franchise, which is, you know, effectively in some ways like what the ISIS caliphate is.
McDonald's.
Franchises, yeah.
There's a ton to unpick here. I want to tease out three strands. The first is the US warnings and the sort of CIA pre-debunking that we've talked about on this before, but just this idea that there were warnings a couple of weeks ago that it looks like Russia either ignored or just kind of passed off as, you know, CIA mind games. The second thing is I want to tease out, and maybe Dmitry can talk about this, is how Putin's going to use this. He's already hinted that he's going to use this to kind of justify stuff against Ukraine, saying that folks were arrested fleeing to the border. And then the third is I'd like to know, and again, this might be for Dmitry as well, given his kind of knowledge of Russia, is how this will affect, I mean, firstly, how this happens, and B, does this affect Putin's kind of credibility in the sense that, I don't know, it's a pretty bad failing of intelligence, domestic intelligence, that, like, I mean, we'd be asking a ton of questions about our governments. I can only assume Russians will be asking the same. So let's start by talking about the CIA. So this was, what, start of March, I think it was, that the State Department, based on intelligence, kind of warned American citizens not to go to big events in Russia, or in Moscow specifically, because there was an imminent attack. It didn't happen imminently. It happened, you know, I think this was kind of like the third or fourth day of March, and it obviously took a couple of weeks. But there was a warning there, and it looks like Russia didn't take advantage of it. Dmitry, anything to say on that? I mean, is this kind of the way the CIA is operating now, is to kind of pre-bunk this stuff that we saw in the start of the invasion?
So the US has a really interesting policy called duty to warn, which is that if they detect credible chatter about an imminent terrorist threat anywhere in the world, even against a adversary or hostile power, they are obliged by their policies to give that power a heads up. It's a really interesting policy. You could do an entire episode on the geopolitics and sort of thinking about. So they appear to have followed that policy. Now, what's interesting is about 3 days before the attack, Putin mentioned these warnings as an attempt by the West to blackmail Russia into something. It wasn't 100% clear. As with a lot of sort of allegations by Putin against the West, it's not really clear that you can name a verb, a noun, and a place.
It struck me was along the vibes of he interpreted as one of those kind of like, it would be a shame if there is a terrorist attack in Moscow. And he saw it as the US kind of mafioso style threatening Moscow that they would, you know, allow a terrorist attack to happen. That's how I interpreted
what he said. Classic mistranslation. We should say also for context, right, that the first thing that Putin did is that he blamed Ukraine. And that's something that I missed in my explainer. So I think that's important context there.
Yeah. And just on that point of how he interpreted it, that's not surprising because he is a bratva thug who thinks in terms of organized crime.
He sees the world through that way.
It's not a mistranslation. It's just like this is how he would behave. So he assumes everyone behaves this way.
Right. Don't try and shake me down kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that is an interesting dynamic. And again, it plays into what we've talked about a couple of times on this podcast, which is this pre-bunking idea that as soon as Helen said, he said, aha, this must be a Ukrainian plot puppeteered by the US puppet masters, the US was able to go, what the hell are you talking about? We literally told you to look out for this. Like, why would we warn you of an attack we were behind? That's insane.
And moreover, that gives credibility to the rest of the world, right? Like, you know, I know you're always on Twitter in battles with the trolls for the lack of your, you know, your own sanity, but it means that the people who are likely to believe that kind of disinformation are mostly confined to the holes in the internet like that, rather than, you know, you don't have a lot of, like, Viktor Orban might be a perfect example that if these things weren't pre-bunked and he was interviewed, you know, a week after attack like this, he might say, hey, we don't know because X, Y, Z. The idea that the US warned Russia 3 weeks ago, I think makes it much harder for him politically to come out and sort of give any kind of credit to that disinformation. And that's just crucial, right? Because disinformation isn't about the information. It's about how hard it is then to build alliances around core goals. So I think I've been a massive proponent of Bill Burns's, like, kind of direction of the CIA in that sense of, like, transparency, using their information. I mean, what does the CIA have? It has information. How do you fight disinformation? With information. Like, it's a really smart approach. And I think in this one, I mean, again, we can't prove a negative, but you see Putin come out and he didn't really blame Ukraine so much as kind of hint that he would like to blame Ukraine. I suspect that the fact that he didn't come out and fully just say that's the Nazis in Kiev was probably because there are questions to be asked, probably internally. There's probably folks inside the Kremlin who are like, oi, what the hell? This is a massive screw up. Like, we are in, you know, this isn't good. And he probably has less political rope to come out and blame others because of this, of the warnings 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, I mean, I think this duty to protect thing is it's a really good move for all spy agencies. And we talked about this in a couple of episodes ago, where I think, you know, we're seeing this trend of fighting disinformation with information from spy agencies from around the world, including Australia's right, a couple of weeks ago. So I think this kind of playbook is something that we are going to see more and more of, especially as because it corners those people who sort of push for disinformation into the corners where they can't really push back. So I don't know. I think that it's ultimately a good thing.
How do we think it's going to affect Putin in Russia? Do we think that there's going to be any lasting kind of damage to his reputation that he can't protect his people? Or do we think there's going to be some, I mean, traditionally when this stuff happens and, you know, my mind is cast back to when he first took power and there were the bombings in Moscow, which some people think he orchestrated, but we don't have to dive into that right now. But he responded by launching horrific wars in Grozny and using that as a, whether he orchestrated it or not, using that opportunity to kind of achieve other goals. Do we think there's a chance that he'll use it to do something in Syria, which is where these guys presumably operate out of? Or do you think he will escalate in Ukraine somehow if he manages to draw that thread? Like what are the ramifications? How's he going to use this?
So this is going to be speculation and mostly vibes, I have to say.
The best kind. I love it.
The best kind. So the context of the initial bombings, the ones that you were just talking about, John, that led to the harsh response, was when Putin was still a comparative unknown compared to how well he's known in Russia. And that was him establishing a reputation domestically for toughness and as the protector of the nation. That was what that harsh response was about. He's in a different spot now because he's been in power for so long. He can't turn around and go, now I'm here to finally take these Muslims in hand and sort of protect you all. So this is a security failure for him. It's hard to blame. It's really hard not to draw parallels with Netanyahu and October 7th. There are limits to those parallels. But again, you had the Israelis warned by the Egyptians. You had a massive intelligence failure and then a massive security failure in the sense that here it took emergency services, or not emergency services, basically Special Weapons and Tactics, the equivalent of Rosgvardia, an hour to turn up and start shooting back. In Israel, there was that sense.
I didn't hear an hour. That's what, like, what explains that?
The response time was an hour,
that.
Which has spawned
which
its own set of conspiracy theories. I'm not an expert on sort of in-city counterterrorism response, but yes, it's pretty nuts.
They respond to folks, you know, burning a poster of Putin or like putting flowers at a shrine.
Or throwing ink in an electoral ballot. Right?
Yeah.
Just to continue that metaphor, the Israeli army was really good at responding to things in the West Bank, but not so good at responding to things in Gaza. The charge is that they took the eye off the ball. And in this case, the Russian security state was depleted by the war in Ukraine and focused on demonstrations against the war. And they took their eye off the ball of this kind
despite
of thing
being
is the
warned.
Charge. Despite being warned because they just ignored it. There is no one who naturally steps up and goes, I can protect you better than Putin. There is no natural candidate for that. I think the last person who could even pretend to make that claim, his plane was shot out of the sky shortly after attempting to seize Moscow.
Pure coincidence, of course. I mean, I think that for Putin, this will probably embolden him domestically and also with allies around, you know, the region. So what I mean by that is there are 20 million or so Muslims living in Russia who have not had the same sort of have grievances against the Russian government. So I think this will probably allow him to come out stronger on some of those policies in the eastern part of the country and crack down. You know, in the past, there's been allegations of human rights abuses against Muslim minorities within Russia. And then I think, you know, given the sort of common targets that the ISIS-K branch has kind of identified, including China, including Pakistan, Afghanistan, Russia, this will probably allow sort of him, Putin, on the foreign policy or sort of like regional and international level to say, look, these folks are crazy. We need to be more hardline against them and sort of their motives in trying to fill like a global caliphate, right? And sort of support some of China's potential crackdowns as well, and Pakistan and Afghanistan. So I don't know, maybe that's too far a bow to draw, but I think that this will certainly tighten sort of like Putin's stances against Muslims in his country.
Well, I think it's interesting because I'm just reading on the New York Times now that the first two suspects have been named. And Dim, maybe you can help me out here because I have very little idea about names and ethnicities in Russia. But The two names are Dalerjon Mirzoyev, M-I-R-Z-O-Y-E-V. That sounds Russian-ish to me, like maybe Chechen or something down there. And then the other one is Saida Krami Rasha Balizoda. And they don't sound like classic kind of, you know, Arabic names from, you know, what I would assume ISIS in Syria or whatever. They seem that in that area that, you know, they are Russians potentially. I don't know, Dimitri.
So it was almost certainly, if it was going to be anyone, it would almost certainly be Central Asian, either Central Asians or Russians from Central Asia adjacent republics. Keep in mind that sort of once you get about 500 kilometers east of Moscow, Russia starts to look visually like Central Asia because that's where people are from. So I can't tell just from those names. They sound Central Asian to me, but they could well be Russian citizens. They could be from Central Asia, could be from anywhere.
I think it is,
but it would be unlikely an attack like this would be Arab Muslims.
Right. That's the point I'm making. I think it's interesting to kind of just note that it's not, you know, someone al-Baghdadi. It's these folks from different parts, more Russian, potentially more Russian, but certainly probably ex-Soviet areas, I would say.
Maybe that's right. I mean, you know, covering Afghanistan, Turkmenistan and Pakistan, right? That sort of region.
All right. Well, tons more is going to come out about all of this over the next days and weeks, I'm sure. So if there's anything massively different or new, we might touch back on it in weeks to come. But I mean, safe to say now, it's a horrible thing to have happened, regardless of what Russia's done in this war, regardless of what anyone ever thinks about any of this kind of stuff. Terrorism is terrorism, and it's horrific. And I know that people will have, I've been reading a lot of people who have conflicted views about that, but I don't think you do have conflicted views about it. It's a horrible thing that happened, and you know, it's that's the point of the duty to warn too, right? Like, terrorism is a blight on everybody, regardless of where it happens. All right, let's pivot to Europe and particularly France, where we have Emmanuel Macron. Let me just set this up. Gun show. I don't know if folks who read our newsletter will have seen a photo of Emmanuel Macron boxing with, let's be honest, like pretty impressive biceps. I was pretty shocked by. He's ripped. I don't know where he finds the time in between running the country and all the other stuff to work out like that, but he looks great. But I think the point that we're trying to make here is that he, in recent
I'll just note that John months, said that and not me in this episode.
Yeah.
I was going to say, is it possible Macron heard about Helen's thirst trap ranking of world leaders and wanted to make a bid?
Yeah. I think that's the only explanation, really. But like sort of more seriously, I guess, it kind of reflects France, I don't want to say like sort of becoming like aggressive or anything like that, but just a little bit more strident on the world stage, particularly, and we'll get into this, vis-a-vis Germany's kind of reluctance to have that traditional role they have in Europe. And I'm going to read a couple of quotes here that Macron has recently said about Europe, the war in Ukraine, this kind of stuff. He said, "Ukraine is an existential issue. If you lose this war, we'll not be able to have any European security. So we have to prepare for all possible scenarios. We need to persuade all European countries to build their own defense policy." And he also said, I've said what our goal is. Russia cannot and must not win this war. Plus, our goal is to bring sustainable peace back to Europe. To achieve this goal, we will not go down the path of escalation because we don't need another war. But we are prepared to say that we have no limits and we will react to how Russia behaves. Both of those comments, I think I chose those two out of the ones that we'd prepared because one, I think the first one is making a pitch for European leadership, really. Kind of like, come on, guys, like let's all get together and bloody do this. And then the second one is pitching France as this kind of like, we're not going to make things worse. We're not going to pick fights. But if you come to us, you better believe we're going to come back with the power of Thor's hammer or whatever the French version of Thor's hammer is. I don't know, Dionysus, what's the Greek god of the Roman god of wine? Something like
Dionysus.
That. Dionysus is bottle of wine, yeah. But like, it's interesting because France has not traditionally, I mean, France and Germany have been the power players in Europe. I would argue that Germany over the last kind of 20 years under Merkel particularly have been the ones kind of taking that leadership role. And it looks like Macron is pitching France in that role now. So I don't know, Dimitri, do you want to take that kind of setup wherever you want?
There's so many places you could take this, and I'm really interested to hear Helen's take, so I won't waffle on too long. Maybe if I just like zoom in on one piece of it, which is you just mentioned there that under Merkel, there was a sense that Germany and France, but mostly Germany, led Europe. But I think firstly, there's now quite a lot of disillusionment with where that led to under Merkel's stewardship, especially vis-a-vis Russia. But also, I think there's a sense that Merkel was very much a peacetime consigliere. Merkel is who you wanted for sort of steady as she goes. No one gets excited. Everyone gets technocrats around a room. Now looking at where France finds itself, it's looking at Europe. And there's a vacuum of leadership. The Germans, Scholz is remarkably weak. Well, it's funny that Germany is contributing a lot more to Ukraine in terms of arms than, say, France is, than almost anybody is. But at the same time, Scholz manages to get almost no credit for it because he does constantly appeal.
He's just so weak.
Yeah. It's just this sense of just nothing there. It's like this sponge-like amoeba is running the world's fifth largest economy. It's insane.
I think they peeked at the helmets.
Yeah, exactly. Right? I don't know German politics well enough to know whether that's because he is somewhat hamstrung domestically, so can't kind of confidently stride the world stage. But either way, he is weak on the world stage.
And then you look at the other players, you've got Donald Tusk in Poland, and you've got, so the Czechs who are being, you've got the Estonians, the Latvians, they're being really active. But Poland's not going to run the European Union, you know? Poland's not going to lead Europe. The Western Europeans won't accept it. So there's this sense that there is this gap. And I think Macron, who is always looking for how to build his legacy and is constantly pivoting himself into the breach, has spotted an opportunity to ride in triumph.
Yeah. I mean, Macron is, I think a lot of his allies have now compared him to Churchill, which is, you know, just such a convenient comparison.
I mean, probably because he begged them to, right?
Yeah. Like, please, if you do this, I will go and do some thirst traps for our party. But I think, you know, there is probably some similarities in the sense of, you know, we've got to sort of fight to be able to win the peace, right? That's sort of the angle that he's taking. But of course, his detractors and his oppositions are saying that he is sacrificing France's position on this for short-term political gain and for electoral victories. I mean, I don't think that it's quite it's not like an analogous kind of comparison to Churchill, because obviously back then in World War II, things were looking really bad. But now I think France is trying to, if you look at it in stark kind of business terms, do a sort of first mover's advantage and stake itself in the ground to say, this is what our stance on Ukraine is. And unfortunately, this is as good as I think Ukraine's going to get from the Europeans for now in terms of, you know, I think, optics of support, because I think I read somewhere else this week that most of Ukraine's allies these days in Europe are either irrelevant or tired or have no money, right? And so short of kind of getting support like this from France or from the US, they're not really sort of in a position of strength. So I don't know. I think that this is a really smart political play by Macron, because obviously he's now pivoted France's position as one of the first in the European Union to do so and really come out boldly in favor of Ukraine. Whether others follow suit, we'll see.
I would push back on a couple of those things. I think, for example, the Czech president's ammunition and artillery shell initiative is phenomenally impactful, where he basically combined sort of Czech energy with other Europeans' money to solve that exact problem, Helen, you were talking about, where sort of the people with the money are tired, the people who aren't tired don't have money. And he kind of squared that circle, and that should make a significant difference. I think the other thing that I would kind of nuance here a bit is that Macron has come out and he said things, this wasn't in one of the quotes you read out, John, but he has been sort of showing some leg on, like, oh, we might have to deploy European troops to sort of defend Odessa and Kiev, which is so far beyond the Western appetite at the moment. It may as well no longer be on the same plate. And stepping back and thinking about the strategy behind that, he almost certainly has no intention of actually doing that. Moreover, he knew that as soon as he said it, that would become the story. His allies would yell at him for being too daring. You know, Russia would accuse him of all sorts of things, and he wouldn't have to do it, but he could position himself as like, I'm the only one brave enough to say it.
But what's in it for him?
I think political advantage, right? I think there are folks who are going to see that
as
strong.
You mean domestically?
Domestically, yeah, French domestically. I think, you know, the Le Pen voters, for example, have come behind him for that. And I think he really needs to, you know, needs this to kind of drum up support domestically.
Well, I mean, it's, again, I don't know French politics inside and out, but I mean, he's obviously not run, he can't run again for president, right? In the next elections in 2026 or whenever they are, they're a ways away. So presumably there's some dynamic of him trying to carve out some longevity for his party and the kind of third wave of French politics that he brought in with En Marche back in whenever he was first elected. So he's probably trying to do some legacy slash longevity building. But I think for me, you know, I don't want to talk just about Ukraine, because I think actually France's kind of development of their identity, I don't want to say that because obviously France has an identity, but this kind of new bolshiness strikes me very much as downstream from Macron's view of how Europe should act in the world. He understands that China is around for, you know, the next 50 years and America is around for the next 50 years, but the rest of the world is really uncertain. We use the $10 word multipolarity to describe that, but it's just this idea that there's going to be a ton of power bases around the world that can influence their region. And I think Macron's strong view is that Europe should be a third balancing pole of power between China and the US. But he looks around Europe right now and he goes, God help me, how are we going to do this? Germany has absolutely sold itself to Russia and I think has lost credibility with its kind of policy of the last 15, 20 years under Merkel and its kind of embrace of Russia. Spain couldn't organize its way out of a wet paper bag. The rest of Europe, as you said, is either too small, too poor, or too kind of dealing with its own stuff to deal with this. And what you're trying to say is Europe has to become a collective superpower. And I think Macron, by saying these things about Ukraine, I mean, he was off in China the other day months ago, glad-handing the Chinese and sort of projecting Europe's power in that way and undermining Ursula von der Leyen too, I should say. So I suspect he's got, like, again, Napoleon is a bad analogy, but the idea of, like, he sees himself as the leader of a Europe that is trying to become a superpower and that it has more to do with that than it does Ukraine, than it does Le Pen, than it does anything else. But I don't know. Thoughts, Dimitri? You're wildly gesticulating.
Maybe I'm just speaking in Italian while on mute. You don't know. I just want to throw in, I think we also, you were talking about Macron's vision for Europe as this third pole, but I think it's also, he envisioned it as a pole between the other two poles, as a kind of mediator, as a sort of reasonable third party. And I think it's important to remember, and there is a absolutely fantastic chronological thread by a journalist called Mustaba Rahman, I'll put in the comment notes, which goes through Macron's journey with Putin over the last couple of years, where initially, if everyone throws their minds back to early 2022, Macron saw himself as the mediator and was trying to talk Putin off the ledge.
He was the only person who said, I'll pick up the phone to Putin, and Putin didn't pick up the phone, right? He was really trying hard to be like, hey, we got to talk to these people, like, even if it's evil.
But, like, Putin did at various points. Putin was talking directly to Macron. In fact, Macron has now released the recording of their conversation.
But I think I recall from the time, too, that he was widely panned as being naive and being taken advantage of, right?
Let's not forget that famous or infamous big table as well, Tablegate.
Yes.
Which spurned 1,000 memes.
Yeah, Macron went to Moscow. Macron did all of these things and Putin strung him on. It's not like Putin was telling him, get the hell out. We're definitely invading Ukraine. There's nothing you can say to us.
Right.
Macron felt like Putin made him look like a chump by pretending to engage while never intending to call off the invasion. And so if anything, that was such a potent symbol of the fact that this dream vision, where you have a US and China at one another's throats and glorious Europe forging sort of compromise between them through enlightened French diplomacy, was dealt a really harsh blow, that you can't just be the velvet glove. You need a fist in there too.
Helen.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think there's much to add to that from what I've already said.
Let me be controversial. Do you think that it's in the French bones to want to be beyond their own borders? They've obviously been booted out of Africa, and are they looking at Ukraine as kind of a place where they can have influence in the future? Am I kind of being too provocative by suggesting that they want? I mean, they're not going to colonize Ukraine, but my point is they've lost a lot of influence in the last couple of years.
Yes.
In Africa, and is this them kind of being like, oh well, we need to be influential somewhere, so here's a place we can arguably help.
I think there is an element of that, John. I like that you raised that because I was trying to figure out a way to sort of mention the declining sort of prestige of French imperialism.
Yeah, my reputation's already in the toilet, so you can use me as a vessel for these controversial ideas.
Yes, for the record, John mentioned this, John said this. But no, I mean, look at them in even, you know, French Polynesia and then also the Seychelles region in Africa, right, and or North Africa as well, and as well as their influence in sort of the former French areas in the Levant as well, Lebanon. So I think internationally what we've seen in the last 50 years is this gradual and recently very sharp decline of French influence around the world. So I think this in some ways is like a sort of easy kind of, you know, low-hanging fruit win for the French to say, hey, we are still relevant geopolitically at the international level and we can have an influence with, you know, within our region. So there's also that really great photo that came out of, I think, a few weeks ago now, of him embracing Zelensky, right, to sort of show that he's really, really taking this on seriously as a win for France. And so, yeah, I think there's elements of people who remember the French Empire as sort of welcoming this new approach to trying to be relevant again.
If you think about the big European powers that historically used to run the world in sort of more recent memory, I'm not talking about sort of the Portuguese sailing to Japan.
The good old days.
Exactly. The UK has been able to retain a sense of influence because of their proximity to the US. Germany, following World War II, has sort of been exiled from the community of potentially globally influential nations due to their kind of historic cringe. They can't be expansionist for sort of fairly good reason. Whereas France, you know, France did actively try to hold on. When we talk about sort of modern militaries, France is about the only one other than the US that can independently deploy an expeditionary force, considerably
like
beyond
force.
Its borders. Yeah. Exactly. The UK
still has a foreign legion.
It still
Correct.
Literally has a foreign
That's
legion.
Right.
It's like it has never stopped thinking of itself as a big world player and not in that slightly twee nostalgic way that you get sort of in the UK. This isn't pubs. This is how they form their foreign policy. And I think this is what we're seeing is a manifestation extension of that.
Yeah. And I think what I'll add there, Dim, and this is kind of like certainly not my idea, did not hear it here first, is that the world is now going to, you know, another $10 word, going to power players, right? It's an order of power players, which, you know, ancient civilizations like the Iranians and Persians and the Chinese are kind of coming out and sort of like flexing their power again. And what we've seen in terms of the multipolarity, in the homogeneity of global world order, everyone getting along in the last 50 years or so is actually a blip in history. So I think as part of this broader trend, I really think that France is also leaning into this power game, right? And trying to flex in literally and metaphorically their stance in the world.
Maybe we wrap up this conversation by asking you, Dimitri, what does Europe look like in 10 years, 2034, what is the order of power? Like, it won't be Macron, or it probably won't be Macron, but is France kind of the leader of Europe? Or, and extra points if you agree with me on this, or the Visigoths or the Vandals going to come back and we're going to really go back and retrograde? Maybe the Romans are going to, Italy's going to stand up again. But more seriously, what's Europe going to look like? Is it going to succeed in that third pole, or is it going to be a client state, or is it going to be fractured? What's your best guess?
I think if we just bribe off the Vikings, we can protect the wealth of our churches long enough to establish coastal fortifications. Exactly. No, I've never been very good at prognosticating. I think you're going to see a far more active and assertive Eastern bloc of Europe. And by that, I mean sort of the Baltics. Poland is going to make a play for much greater prominence within Europe. I think you're going to see Finland and Estonia assert themselves more just because they become the Great Wall. If Russia is going to be the White Walkers of the next few decades for Europe, these are the guys who see themselves as manning the wall. And they also see themselves as the characters who were warning about the White Walkers the entire time while everyone else squabbled internally for the Iron Throne. I'm
going to
keep this metaphor going until one of you literally throws something.
Wait, who is King's Landing then? who's got King's Landing? Who are the Lannisters?
Oh, God.
I don't even
Putin.
Know what you're talking about.
I don't know.
So Dim and I can take this conversation offline. Anyone yeah, wants
if,
to
if you
us,
wouldn't
feel
mind,
free.
Yeah. That vision of Europe, Dimitri, is a security first Europe, probably centered around NATO in response to a Russian bit of aggression in Ukraine and slash ongoing aggression. Macron, I think, has a view of Europe playing a more wholehearted, fulsome role on the world stage, where it is in China, it is in the Asia Pacific, it is in Africa, kind of being a trader, a technology, you know, developer, all this kind of stuff. Whereas the Europe you just kind of painted is, well, let's close ranks and literally put up the wall because we've got the Russians on the doorstep.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm not saying it's wrong. It's an interesting framing that maybe despite the idea that they want to walk the world stage, the reality is they've got to take care of their backyard first.
Well, I think that this is the key point, that previously they thought that they had the guaranteed security of the US military blanket, behind which they could then play this slightly more warm and fuzzy role, because if push ever came to shove, their security interests were guaranteed. I think now you are going to see them saying, well, as you say, it is going to be a security-focused Europe with NATO at its core, but a NATO that tries to stand more on its own two feet because US assistance is only ever very likely, but no longer assured.
I couldn't agree with that more, Dim. I think my anecdotal sort of input into that is that the French ambassador in DC has never held this many soirees as in the last couple of years, according to folks who are on that soiree circuit. But yeah, let that be a sort of anecdote of what's happening behind
Helen,
the scenes.
Helen, do you largely agree that this is where Europe's going to be in 10 years, kind of security focused, trying its best to have cultural or monetary, financial, economic influence elsewhere, but really focused on keeping itself together?
I do. And I think that that's mainly because without sort of unity, they've realized that they can't survive in this new world. So I think it's more out of sort of survival and the need to kind of keep themselves together and keep themselves competitive than anything else. So anyway, maybe I disagree with the NATO part. I think that they're going to become economically more integrated, or they'll need to sort of move towards that way in order to be more competitive in the international global market. And with NATO being sort of, I think, the kind of dual, the other pole that's sort of holding up Europe.
European economies being broadly competitive on the world stage is something I'll believe when I see it. But my bias is towards European efficiency notwithstanding. I think that's a really interesting conversation. Let's end it there because I think we're running out of time, and we've always got to get to our bit where we chat about what we're going to be talking about this weekend so that we have something in our back pocket to not bore people with. Pub chat, cocktail chat, whatever you want to call it. Helen, why don't we start with you today? What's on your mind?
I'm going a bit off piece today, and it's about a book, which I've been trying to get through sort of since last year, but of course the Netflix series came out and I've had to catch up very quickly. And that book is called The Three-Body Problem, which is by a Chinese author actually called...
One of my faves.
How, have you read him? Or have you seen his stuff?
I read all three a while ago. I was OG.
Dang it, John,
I
you're ahead of the curve. Okay, well, as you'll know, it's an excellent, excellent series. And for those who don't have the time to sort of get through the books, the series on Netflix has just come out and it sort of talks about sort of the future of the world and our, without putting in too many spoilers, our interactions with an alien species, and has a lot of interwoven kind of geopolitics, astrophysics, sort of the state of humanity and all of those big themes that come through, and was initially started from the Cultural Revolution in China. So it sort of looks at the state of humanity through that lens from the beginning. So that's been really, really great. My second quick thing that I was going to mention is actually a conversation Dim and I had about his book. Now, I don't know if folks know, but Dim's book is actually a top seller, like the number one bestseller on the international law textbooks page, or sort of that category, right? International law. Now, have a guess, and I'll pass this on to Dim, at what the second best seller is. Dim, over to you.
Yeah, look, it's tough competition here in new releases in international law, but I am currently edging out Bill Werity's book, The Complete Italian Dual Citizenship Handbook. So just two juggernauts duking it out at the top of the bestseller list. Me and Bill.
And half
two salient topics. Yeah, in the US.
Of course, everyone's trying to leave the US, become Italian citizens.
This is the international look new releases category. I have no idea why Amazon told me this, but now I know it. Now Helen knows it. Now you all know it.
That's brilliant. I love that. All right. Well, I was going to chat about a TV show as well, but I feel like that's a little boring. So I'll maybe leave that for a week. And actually, as I was lying in bed this morning on Sunday morning, reading the New York Times, as I tend to do, there's this fascinating story I came across, and I love stories like this, and stories like this tend to only happen in America. But there was a story about a guy who moved into the New Yorker Hotel, which is a kind of average hotel. I mean, I think it was once a very glamorous hotel, but now it's a very average hotel in New York City. I think it's in Midtown, I'm not sure. But he moved in, paid $200 for a room. But it turns out he had been doing a ton of research on old New York laws that allowed any guest in a building that was listed in this law to take the room for the night and then apply or actually inform the manager of the hotel that they would be taking out a short-term lease on the room. And the manager then had to lease it under a rent-controlled thing that was brought in the 1960s. So the rub of this guy clearly he's clearly a bit of a weird character, but he's gone through the archaic laws, moved in, paid $200 for a night. So fine, that's a normal room. They've come to say, out you get, like it's noon, checkout time. He's gone, I don't think so. I've applied for a lease. You have to give it to me for $88 a week or something like that.
That is amazing.
It gets weirder. So he got evicted and he went down, got a court judgment based on this law. And what the judge did, and this is all pretty recent, I'm talking like 2020 or something, 2019, something like that, but based on a 1950s or 60s law, he got the deed to the building signed over to him somehow. And that bit isn't clear, but basically the judge said, yes, you have the right to this apartment inside the building. So you don't have to pay rent. There was no rent mentioned. And they registered, but because you can't register a hotel room inside a hotel, they don't split it up like apartments. It's just a whole hotel. They signed over the property deed to the whole New Yorker building, which is a, you know, I don't know, like 2,000 room hotel in the middle of New York. He then went on and like demanded rent from the cafes and like all this kind of stuff and said, we're going to have to fix all this stuff that annoyed him. The end of this, it's a fascinating story. He ended up living for free in this room and also quite a shit room too. I think it was like a tiny, tiny little hotel room for 5 years. And he was evicted officially recently, I think a couple of weeks ago. And he's going to be arrested, I think, because ultimately, I think basically everyone was just like, yeah, okay, stop taking the piss. Maybe you were technically correct, but obviously this is nonsense. But he's fighting it in court. So it's this crazy, crazy story of archaic laws, someone with too much time on their hands. And I truly think this kind of stuff only happens in America where someone pushes these little loopholes to the absolute extreme and is willing to go to jail for it. But it's a fascinating story.
Was it the origin story of Donald Trump?
It could, yeah, well, it could well be. We post a link to it because it was a good just like Sunday morning read where I was like, how does any of this happen? And the judge just sitting there being like, well, you know what? Like, I kind of have to just agree with you here because that's what the 1962 rent control law says. Anyway, Dimitri.
Clearly has been following the Supreme Court where if you don't like a law, just write your own. It's fine.
I also imagine if he'd put that much effort into like, you know, something vaguely constructive, he'd probably be a partner in
like
a law firm
podcast.
And be able to buy the building. Or like a podcast. He'd be doing tens of downloads like we do.
That's the dream.
Or writing a book that beats out the Italian dual handship. Dual citizenship handbook. Dual handship.
I mean, he should have realistic goals. That is the champion's path right there. He should aim modestly. What I will be boring people with, I will be issuing a dire warning because I can see a horrible policy discourse coming down the pipe because there has started to be increasing chatter about declining birth rates and pronatalism policies, and it is going to be awful. So the backstory is birth rates in the West are pretty low. People are sort of freaking out. People aren't having enough kids. We pretty much know what policies are required to encourage people to have more kids. And it's things like affordable housing, affordable childcare, good ability for women to reintegrate seamlessly back into the workforce after having kids without all of this stuff's really, really hard to do. And it's really, really expensive. So instead, governments are going to do weird, cringe nonsense. And they have already started. Hungary is spending obscene amounts of money on this, on just like campaigns to encourage more sex, but in like a conservative way. It is going to be an awful, awful discourse. And we are going to see some of the worst, dumbest, most cringe policy imaginable within the next couple of years as this freak out about replacement rates meets the like, we must do something. Well, you could do this. Well, we're not going to do that. Why don't we do this other thing? So I am going to be warning people to just like mute the word natal on all of their social media sites and just start running as soon as someone starts talking about it.
Do you get a lot of invites to cocktail parties?
I was just going to ask the same thing.
Not twice. Not twice in a row.
Never twice. Like,
we'll just finish the podcast on light things. Oh yeah, by the way, it's going to be hell out there, folks. Don't forget. Don't ever forget.
But you are going to see some truly, truly funny, like, boink your husband posters. So there's good with
that. I'll spin this for you. What you're doing is the equivalent of pre-bunking like the CIA did, so that when it happens, it'll be less upsetting, less offensive, and we'll all know what's happening. Thank you, Dimitri, for your service.
Yes.
Like, we need more people thinking we're CIA.
That's right. I'm happy to let them think that. Mm. All right, folks, we've ticked over the hour here. We've made a promise every week to kind of keep it tight, and we never do, but we will leave it there. You know, it was a bit of a different podcast this week. We wanted to talk a bit more about Russia than we had planned to just because of the events over the weekend. So hope that was somewhat interesting. And we'll be back next week with whatever comes up in the news in the coming days. And until then, Dimitri, thank you so much for joining me as always.
Thank you so much.
Helen from Australia, you'll be in Australia again next week. So you'll be hopefully tanned and relaxed and vibing.
Do I not look tanned and relaxed now? I mean, that's
a fantastic. Well, I think I was going to say the only problem is the internet's so bad in Australia, you're all pixelated, so I can't tell.
That's just my
One day we'll get past dial-up down there.
We need fiber to the Helen.
That's it. All right, everybody. Thank you so much, and we'll be back next week.
Dialogue editing, mixing, and mastering for this episode was done by Marissa Ewing of Hemlock Creek Productions.